Good afternoon. As I mentioned, currently I'm at Emory University, but did serve for 3 years in the Peace Corps, where I taught English. But when I wasn't teaching English, the primarily very passionate work that I was accomplishing was focusing on the suicide epidemic that afflicts primarily young men in within Micronesia. So really quite fortuitous that I'm getting to talk today about my work in Chuuk, which is the same state that Sarah just got to share about as well. And I also have nothing to disclose with respect to my presentation today. And as you saw in Sarah's map, Micronesia spans over 1,000 miles in the western equatorial Pacific Ocean. And so within the Federated States of Micronesia, the country itself, I was focused here in Chuuk State, but out in the Mortlach Islands. The Mortlachs are about 150 nautical miles southeast of Chuuk. The island that I lived on, Moch Island, was roughly a quarter mile squared in size. So that's about 50 football fields stacked next to each other. Home to about 500 people at any given time and only 5 feet above sea level at its highest. So just give some context to the micro in Micronesia. Suicide in Micronesia was first recognized as a major public health issue in the late 1960s, but it wasn't documented in a peer-refereed journal until 1976. Which showed the suicide rate climbing from 10 per 100,000 across the country to 50 per 100,000 by the 1980s. In Chuuk State, the rate was 5 times that, specifically among young men. And in 2002, a quantitative ethnographic study conducted by a sociologist at the University of Guam, this 2002 study being the most recent peer-reviewed study that I could find, demonstrated that 1 in 40 young men in the 10-year span of life between their 15th and 24th birthdays will commit suicide. 1 in 40. To understand suicide, one first must understand the family and its cultural significance within Micronesia. From the time they're young, boys are socialized to minimize conflict and to defer to the family and the community's collective good. When serious suicide-causing conflict happens, it usually starts in the family. This according to the scholar, historian, and Jesuit priest, Fran Hazel. As boys grow older and attempt to assert their autonomy or their individual agency, someone in the collective extended family, usually the oldest maternal uncle, would say no or otherwise put the young man back in his place, so to speak. In this case, the father or another uncle or another family member could intervene proactively to address his son's anger and frustration. You can see in the model how a young man could go from a place of mental wellness in the first box to a state of conflict, the second box shaded in red, because of a decision by a strong authority figure or an action on his own part. But how another family member, perhaps the father in this case, could intervene to redirect the young man back to a place of mental wellness by addressing and attempting to neutralize the conflict and anger. However, since the 1960s, changing notions of the family following World War II, particularly away from large extended decision-making family clan units toward a more Western nuclear family model, has undercut the protective functions of the family and instead left bare and even exacerbated the conflict causing elements of family conflict causing elements of family and community. As you can see in the model, no longer is the father really able to intervene, and thus the son's anger is often left unabated, leading to his withdrawal from the family in order to culturally and appropriately give conflict time and space to dissipate. Unfortunately, over the past 50 years or so, this withdrawal has been actualized in a very severe and final way, that in the form of suicide. Finding and nurturing a protective entity to supplant the father's traditionally protective role has been my goal in much of my work and research on Micronesian suicide since 2008. It's what took me to Emory to pursue public health, and in 2013 to return to the islands to conduct this research when following up on the health outcomes of boys who'd attended a health promotion camp I started in 2010 while I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I want to be clear that suicide is an incredibly complex decision process, and when survivors have talked to me about their suicidal experiences, they've reiterated that many factors and contextual nuances inform their experiences. My study question seeks to understand just one part of the experience of suicidal behavior, not with the intention of preventing all suicides, but better understanding how intervening in this area might make a positive difference in the lives of some who experience suicidal ideation and those who make suicide attempts. And as you can guess by the title of the presentation, it's the Christian Church where I see both opportunities and barriers to addressing suicide. It should be said that the islands are overwhelmingly Christian in religious identity, a near even mix between Catholics and Protestants, and it is the Church that increasingly enforces and defines important elements of Micronesian culture. Could the Church then also be a force for good in creating a culture around conflict and suicidal behavior that could, in some contexts, prevent it? And this was the research question which I asked the young men in the study that I was conducting. So the study came about as part of a larger evaluation of a camp, as I mentioned, that I created in 2010. 39 young men between the ages of 14 and 18 who'd attended one of three camps between 2010 and 2012 were invited to participate in a 30-minute qualitative interview, in-depth interview. I worked through gatekeepers, usually principals, pastors, and traditional chiefs, to obtain informed consent from them, from the families themselves, and lastly, but most importantly, from the boys. And because it reflects a deep and emic perspective, I used in-depth interviews to motivate my participants to discuss various health topics, including suicide, in their own ways and using their own words. But because I was on the islands with no running water, let alone electricity, I did not and could not electronically record our interviews, which I conducted in the Chukchi's language. So I took detailed notes during and after the interviews, which I almost entirely inductively coded using their words. Three of the codes that were most prominently featured in my analysis were hell, which translates the same, tipis, which means sin, and phio, which means conflict. I used thematic analysis, specifically in the Max QDA qualitative research software suite, to make sense of this data. So as I looked to see whether the Christian Church could effectively replace the father as an intervention point to prevent suicide among young men, what did I find by asking young men to tell me about their suicide experiences vis-a-vis the religion? Well, I found what Hazel and what Rubenstein had already said, that suicidal behaviors triggered by family conflict. I found something that 3 years of living in the islands had told me, that very intimate and powerful emotions, especially the kind of emotions engendered by suicide-producing conflict, are not discussed openly, but rather are kept hidden in secret because of feelings of embarrassment and shame. And while I'll touch on these two findings, I want to spend most of my remaining time looking at the third, which is that shame about suicide in particular is rooted in religious teachings and sayings that conceptualize suicide as sin. Looking at the conflict itself, of 13 participants who reported a suicidal behavior themselves or of a friend, 10 named family as a source of their own or their friend's suicidal ideation or suicide attempts. I asked them, if you've ever considered suicide, what event precipitated it? And the responses all pointed to some family matter at the heart of the conflict, from family stuff to a feeling that their independence is being sacrificed too much to the family, to a lack of control over their decision-making abilities. On the other end of the model, looking at the pathways that go through the intervention point to either return to mental wellness or to lead to suicide, I asked the participants whether they'd ever talked about their suicidal feelings to anyone. Of the 13 participants who mentioned some suicide behavior experience, 11 said no, they had not talked about it to anyone, and 5 said that they were ashamed. The shame responses I got had distinct elements. Personal shame is evidenced by the boy who expressed fear that others would find out that he was ashamed, and that he had told those suicidal feelings. One respondent told me about his friend, who he said was too ashamed to tell him about his suicidal feelings, so they got drunk and acted out the suicidal behavior as a way of expressing the conflict and frustration. The third example was unique. And I can't say for certain that this is what happened, but it should be noted that it's a common technique in Micronesia at least, but in several of the cultures there, to tell one's own experiences by way of a third party, by way of the story through a friend's lived experience, for example, as a way to sort of get rid of the personal component to it and sort of neutralize any emotion, personal investment that might be behind it. So this respondent told me about a friend who he knew was suicidal, but that his own shame over the friend's suicidal thoughts and behaviors prevented him from intervening because he considered the behavior sin. It's likely that this was the boy talking about his own experience, because I can't explain, and he wasn't able to explain, how else he knew that his friend was suicidal, given the fact that they really don't discuss that. But like this respondent, that last respondent, who equated suicidal behavior with sin, four more participants also connected shame with sin and suicide. Specifically, it's the shame of their feelings being sinful that prevents boys from discussing this behavior with one another or with parents, with religious leaders, or with teachers. And culturally, you know, this isn't surprising, as boys really don't open themselves up to be vulnerable in front of one another in the society. In the traditional model, when fathers were able to intervene, they did so proactively by preempting the feelings that they knew their sons would be experiencing because of the conflict. So when I asked the boys, why are you ashamed, all five of them said something about the church or about a religious teaching. And you can see what they said. You know, what's important to note about these respondents' feelings of shame is ultimately the preventive effect that their shame had on their suicide. The five boys who felt shame about their suicidal feelings did not complete suicide, as evidenced by their participation in the study. And so while shame did prevent them from discussing suicide on the front end, at least for these boys, the church's teaching that suicide is sin had a protective effect, and it prevented them from completing the action. And this this realization, you know, makes it very hard to put forward a compelling case, at least to religious leaders, on why sin shouldn't be the framework which we use to discuss suicide within the church context. Because as some of them said to me when I presented it to them, well, it looks like our teachings are working. So, you know, as I kind of processed on all of these things and considered sort of all these results in sum, it's safe to make a couple, you know, points that are worth considering. First is that even with their physical separation and infrastructural hurdles, Micronesian culture is mirroring Western notions of family and individuality more and more, so it's not really realistic to expect a resurgence of the traditional family model to offer a protective role. We're seeing that suicides are becoming increasingly reported external to family conflict, about issues of employment or fights with friends or other issues outside the family. And you know, this is simply reinforcing the complexity of the suicidal problem within Micronesia, and itself demands a fuller explanation of the issue. You know, and one more point that's, I think, important to note is that culturally, suicide is understood in Micronesia as an intentional, thoughtful, and not irrational decision on the part of a boy to resolve conflict. Suicide is really seen as a culturally appropriate method of withdrawal. And so framing this in terms of mental illness, seeking to provide counseling or medication or helplines, really will not be as an effective means of addressing this of addressing suicide as they could be in perhaps other settings. And so, you know, looking at the way that the church has contextualized the issue and knowing the church's importance and role in setting the culture within Micronesia, I think that any discussion about really addressing suicide proactively has to start with the church. We know it from the study that boys' shame, at least among survivors, is church-created or at least church-reinforced. And so while it does maybe prevent some boys from taking harmful action in the end, you know, for many boys who also identify as Christian, but who do complete suicide, the question has to be asked whether the sin's stigmatizing effects on their ability to talk about suicide, on their ability to seek help, on their ability to discuss the conflict that led up to it. What would it look like if the church was involved on the front end of this? What if the culture changed and suicide was not discussed as sin? Or what if it wasn't the only sin? What if the sin was reconceptualized instead as the failure of the church or of the religious community at large to do something to reconcile conflict when it occurs within the family or increasingly external to the family? I think that the church has an opportunity to set a really new and positive cultural direction by engaging this very constructively. I want to just mention a few limitations to the study because they're important to think through as I kind of get close to wrapping up with some future directions. Obviously, we used convenient sampling out of the way that this project was put together as a follow-up study with the boys who attended my camp. That was partly because I knew them, I had relationships with them, and they knew who I was. And since I was conducting the interview in Chukis, there needed to be some familiarity there to make that even possible. Future studies can certainly do a better job of attaining probability samples and getting the necessary equipment and battery-powered machines there to record the interviews so we can go fuller and deeper toward a more grounded theory of this issue. Suicide completers are always going to be underrepresented in any suicide research, and this is especially so in Micronesia, where rarely, almost never, does a boy or a girl, for that matter, when it occurs, leave a note explaining their suicide. And so that's just another complex factor that has to be understood, and really, you know, just again further reiterates the fact that suicide is very complex, and we really can't and won't be able to understand all the dimensions of suicide. This study, no exception to that. And finally, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't name the fact that as a white man, as a Peace Corps volunteer, and as an outsider, I was looking through my own cultural lenses as I addressed this project, and those really can't be understated. Because no amount of reflexivity or cultural competence on my part as the researcher can overcome those hurdles, and I think point us to maybe one of the most important future directions of this study, which is increasing the capacity of Micronesians, Chukis specifically, to engage this work, to be about this important research, and especially to be involved in the design of interventions and the analysis of these kinds of projects, so that we really will have a fuller, more rounded understanding of suicide in all of its forms and facets. So where do we go from here? Well, I think, you know, the first place is to religious leaders themselves to understand more about them and the source of their theological understandings and teachings on suicide, but primarily also about their knowledge and skills and attitudes about suicide itself. As far as I can tell, there have been no studies exploring religious leaders' competence or self-efficacy at addressing suicide constructively. And that has to be a necessary first step before any kind of prevention intervention could take place that would involve churches or religious communities. I think related, there should be an honest look by religious leaders and by the whole faith community at how stigmatizing this behavior, or any behavior for that matter, contributes to or detracts from the purpose of these churches to spiritually develop and nurture congregations in their Christian beliefs and practices, what we would consider a Christian spiritual formation with a Christian religious practice. I think such a study would be revealing in the thoughts of members of faith communities, and particularly young men, about how they relate to the church, given the stigma and the shame that they feel as a result of the church's teachings. This may be an important first step to getting churches and religious leaders themselves to understand the import and the effect of their words, and would be a necessary first step to getting religious leaders maybe more aware and on board with sort of a reconceptualization of sin, of suicide as sin. Finally, in an effort to build a fuller, more complete conceptual framework about suicide among young men in Micronesia, future studies really should be exploring the concept of ideation in more nuanced detail. No single study can fully parse the different ways that ideation is discussed by young men. Does a boy who completes suicide in Micronesia always ideate beforehand, or is it a very spur-of-the-moment decision? How is ideation related to attempts? Are attempts always intended to lead to a completed suicidal act? Or are they means of exposing conflict and resolving it when no other constructive means of overcoming withdrawal can be addressed? How do these aspects of suicide relate? Unfortunately, or perhaps fortunately, this current study introduced just as many questions in my mind that I couldn't address effectively, but still demand attention and will be vital to researchers and behavior change experts if meaningful progress is to be made addressing the suicide epidemic in Micronesia, and really, for that matter, anywhere. I won't name them all, but I have received tremendous support both within Micronesia and from without at Emory to conduct this study, to put the results together, make sense of them, and bring them to you today. And so I am indebted to these folks for their support in that respect. In your handouts, too, there are the citations for this project, and you can see that I've relied heavily on ethnographic fieldwork from Fran Hazel and Don Rubenstein, and I would commend it to you if you're interested in suicide in the Micronesian region, or even more abstractly, the way that these two have conducted, you know, a life's worth of anthropological and ethnographic work, and they've done so in, I think, a quite culturally competent and sound manner. Thank you very much.